Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. Today I'm talking to a French Anglophile journalist who was born in Paris and has lived and worked in London since the mid-1990s. She's the UK editor for Marianne and she's a contributor to many leading publications around the world. Her latest book, Left Bank, Art, Passion and the Rebirth of Paris, 1940 to 1950, is her second in English. It's published by Bloomsbury. It's already been deemed an enormous success. It's a cultural history of the Left Bank during that time, from the German occupation of World War II, through liberation and the birth of existentialism and the Fourth Republic. It's told through the eyes of mid-century artists and thinkers whose lives, loves, collaborations and passions were forged against the wartime destruction and post-war rebirth of Paris. So I'm absolutely thrilled to welcome to the programme Agnès Poirier. Agnès, thanks for coming.
My pleasure.
Now, we're talking here at Cheltenham Literary Festival. We've just done a session on stage where people were absolutely entranced. And so before we go into your work, I wonder if we could just explore a little bit the culture of literary festivals, because it always seems to me extraordinary that on a rainy Sunday morning, 300 people will pack out a venue to listen to somebody talk about a book.
Well, it's surprising to me too, and it's wonderful. It means that the book industry is a thriving one. It's like film festivals, you know, I'm a film critic as well, and there are so many film festivals. You could just, as a film critic, spend your time touring and being this sort of professional tourist going from one festival to another. It's also, you know, with literary festivals, it's the same. It's a way for film directors, or in that case, writers, to meet their readers, because it's a very lonely business. You're, you know, in your study and you write and you wish that you'll interest people, but you don't know. And then the your conversation with your readers is very enlightening very often, because they see things that you hadn't seen, and it forces you to reconsider and perhaps improve. And I've had some very lovely encounters with people who were very enthusiastic about the book, but also who were very generous enough to tell me, oh, on page 27, there's a typo. On page 29, there's actually, I don't think you mean this. And I checked, and each time they were right. It's almost a collaborative process, and it's great. And I'm always in awe of people who actually pay to hear you, but also then buy your book. They are fantastic.
They absolutely are. And as you say, it's a great kind of social experience too. Let's talk about your life and work, because you grew up in France. What part of France? And was it a particularly literary family?
I grew up in Paris and left for London when I was 22 to do a PhD at the London School of Economics. I didn't complete my PhD because I straight away started to write as an arts London correspondent for Le Monde, and then for Le Figaro, and then for Libération, etc., French daily newspapers. And my family, no, was not particularly literary. Having said that, my mother was a playwright and then a reporter and a writer as well, not of nonfiction. And just normal, middle-class Parisian family.
And here now, you bounce between the two countries. You have a kind of dual life in a way. And I wonder how that affects how you write and how you read, what languages you're operating in, and if your thought processes change depending on the language.
Oh, completely. I wasn't brought up in Britain. So I'm fundamentally French in the sense that I spent my first 22 years in France. However, I didn't know what to be French meant until I arrived in the UK. At first, I wanted to become English in a French way. You integrate, you change your name. I wanted to change my name because nobody could actually pronounce it properly. And my British friends said, but of course not. That's your identity. But I couldn't care less about my French identity if it couldn't be translated into English and be understandable to my new British friends. One thing led to another. I was only in London to do a PhD and I stayed. And I now come to a point where I spent half of my life in the UK and half in France. I now commute between the two because I comment on the news and I write for Anglophone newspapers and French newspapers on Britain and France. So I'm in a slightly schizophrenic position. I think in both languages, but I very much feel British in France and French in Britain. That makes me a true European, I guess. But it's a wonderful thing, I thought, of being an alien everywhere you are and yet feeling extremely familiar with the places, because I feel the same in Europe. Europe is really like a garden, my back garden. I do report a lot throughout Europe, so in Italy, Belgium, in Holland, in Germany, in Spain. It makes, you know, your life richer.
And your work is very rich too, in that you're not just writing about film or culture or society. You're also, as you say, writing on politics. And those are really quite different forms. Hard politics is very different from art critique.
Well, probably because I studied political science in France, but also history. And I come from kind of, my father was an actor, and I've got a film director for a brother and a diplomat. So in a way, I'm just doing what I know. That is to say, you know, my first article was a review of a Royal Shakespeare Company's production of Les Enfants du Paradis, Children of Paradise, that 1945 masterpiece of French cinema, adapted by Simon Callow. And I was drawn to review it for a French readership. But that makes me extremely French in a way that you can't, you know, arts or politics or society, you know, we are engaged citizens and they don't live in vacuum. You know, the arts, politics are connected and so is society. And so in a way, it's just one many facets of what it is to be a citizen.
All art is politics. Let's talk about your books, because you've written five. Two of those in English. What was your first book?
My first book was called Les Nouveaux Anglais, as in the New English. Basically, my first four books were about the differences between Britain and France in a sort of current affairs, light way, very much journalistic essays, short and quick and really based with the current affairs. So I wouldn't want anyone to read my previous book, which was written 12 years ago and talks a lot about Gordon Brown and Tony Blair and Nicolas Sarkozy. The world has changed quite a lot since. And what is funny is that it's a genre itself, you know, in the UK, this sort of France, Britain, looking at each other. There's A Year in Provence, of course. But I don't know if you remember A Year in the Merde by Stephen Clarke, who happens to live in Paris. And it took me a long time to leave that niche. I felt that I had said everything I had to say and that, you know, I couldn't make my whole career about explaining the differences between France and Britain. And I wanted to do something more ambitious. So that's Left Bank. And it took me, it didn't take me 10 years to write it, but it took me actually 10 years to convince publishers that I could write something else, because they just wanted me to continue writing the same things, because it's easy, it's fashionable, and there's a public for it, and I quite like the genre, but I felt I had said everything I had to say on the subject.
So this new book, very, very ambitious. I mean, it's got a huge, huge breadth and scope. You go right the way from 1940 to 1950, possibly the most interesting time in Parisian history, although I think we're heading into very interesting waters now. But this is a book that not only unpicks that history and looks at the facts, but it tells it in a very human way. It gives us a lot of stories, almost in a fictionalized way. And that's something that, when we were talking earlier, you pointed out is not at all French.
No, it's true. And actually, I, you know, when I wanted to tell the story, I wanted to tell it for my British friends and American friends, because I really enjoy that genre that exists in British and American literature, which is accessible historical books. It doesn't mean it's not rigorous on the history and the facts, not at all, but it's just told in an accessible and entertaining way. There's a narrative. It's not published by university press, It's published by mainstream publishers, and a way to perhaps interest people into a period and great writers, for instance, or great artists that they wouldn't be necessarily attracted to. So for me, it's a tool to really, all the people in Left Bank are giants. And if I contributed for their writings to be read again, then it's mission accomplished.
Now, some of those giants, of course, people will be hugely familiar with Jean-Paul Sartre. There's Simone de Beauvoir, there's Camus, various others. But a lot of people who aren't very well known. And you begin the book with one of those people, who is Jacques Georgiou, who did an amazing thing and basically saved great art for the world.
Well, that's the thing. You know, there are 32 main characters in the book, and I wanted some of them to be completely unfamiliar to the readership. I wanted that combination of very moving, very endearing characters, but that really deserve to be rediscovered or discovered, and of course the people who are still extremely well known, that the ones you mentioned. And Jacques Georgiou is one I didn't know anything about. Jacques Georgiou, discovered that this man who was the head of the Louvre Museum had foreseen Nazi invasion of France, and from the late 30s had planned very carefully, without telling anyone, a sort of contingency plans and how to hide the entire French public collection. That's a lot of paintings, a lot of sculptures. And in the summer 39, even before the declaration of war, he closed the Louvre Museum for 3 days, officially for reparation and works in the museum, and he summoned hundreds of art students and the very faithful staff of Le Louvre, and they started packing every single one painting and sculpture and work of art of the Louvre, and then taxis, ambulances, trucks, whatever vehicles he could lay his hand on, took all those work of arts to different chateaus, different castles, either private or public, and they were stored there. And 3 days later, the war was declared.
Really, without him, I think we would have lost great, great treasures. From art to photography, and I'm interested in what happened to Cartier-Bresson.
Well, Cartier-Bresson is one of the characters of Left Bank. He, when the war starts, is actually well known because he's travelled a lot to Mexico, to Harlem, and India will come after. And his name at the time is Henri Cartier, and not Henri Cartier-Bresson, because his family was very well known and very wealthy. They were industrialists, and he was a communist. So he didn't want to draw attention on his background. He was also an assistant to the film director Jean Renoir on films like La Règle du Jeu, The Rule of the Games. And he's just, when the war breaks out, he's just one of the many French prisoners of war in Germany, and it will take him 3 years to escape. He does eventually, goes in hiding. We're in 43. And then he goes back to Paris. He hides because he's not supposed to have escaped, basically. And he's with Georges Braque, the painter, when D-Day starts. There's a lovely scene when the two of them, with the wireless in the background, Cartier-Bresson is supposed to take a picture of Braque for a series of monographs that was commissioned by a French publisher, in hiding as well. And then they hear that the D-Day landings have started. And so just at the liberation of Paris in August 44, because he's not very politicized, nor is he very political, but he thinks, I have to be there, I have to take pictures, I have to contribute to documenting at the liberation of Paris. So he actually rides his bicycle for 110 miles, and he's dispatched by the French resistance overseeing photography units. They were very well organized. So he's given Ménilmontant, Belleville, and Saint-Germain-des-Prés, and so he does that for the... And we have some incredible pictures by him, and Robert Doisneau, the other very well-known French photographer, is also among that group. But then he could have become a war reporter. I mean, he could have gone on covering the end of the war, for instance, but that wasn't his thing. He said, I'm not a tourist in disaster land, or a voyeur aristocrat. think he called them. He had tremendous admiration for war reporters, as in photographers, but it wasn't his thing. And there's a lovely anecdote at the Museum of Modern Art of New York. Thought he had died during the war, and they were mounting a retrospective of his life's work. He was only 36 or 37. So they had a shock when they discovered he was still alive, but still, there was so much material already that he had his first big retrospective in 46. And then he went on becoming the photographer we all know.
Tell me about some of the visual artists who were working that time and what impact the war had on their output.
Well, Giacometti, for instance, spent some of the war in Switzerland but also came back. And Giacometti was a very transition time in his career because he had been very successful, earning quite a lot of money during, you know, the 30s. He was associated with the surrealist. And somehow, he didn't have really a breakdown, but he thought, I don't want to continue on that path. And it was very difficult for him to actually materialize the idea he had. He didn't know what he was looking for, but he was looking for something else. And he lived in abject poverty. He had plaster on his hands, on his hair. And he was a close friend of Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre. And he finally found what he was looking for, and he sculpted in his studio where he lived, and it was raining and there was no heater and it was terrible conditions, physical, material conditions. And he invited Beauvoir and Sartre to see The Man Walking, which is probably the most expensive piece of sculpture ever sold, I think, 10 years ago by Sotheby's or Christie's. And Beauvoir tells it in her diaries. She said, you know, we walked around that man walking and we knew something, you know, we were in front of something quite important there. And Sartre talks and writes about it very well, so much that he wrote the catalogue of one of his exhibitions. So Giacometti was born, or the new Giacometti, or the one we remember, and that was recently, I think, exhibited at the Tate Modern in those years.
What about Picasso?
Picasso is a funny one. He was already quite old by the time of the war, but nevertheless, he stayed in occupied Paris. Even for him, it wasn't, you know, it was difficult. And he could have gone anywhere in the world. You know, he could have gone to South America. He had very rich friends. And no, he decided to stay. Nazi officers often came to his studio. And he was forbidden from exhibiting, for instance. And in the morning, because he woke up pretty late in the morning, he would always have friends coming. He would only start working in the afternoon. And it became a kind of, not a salon, but again, Sartre, Beauvoir, Cocteau, a very old friend of his, Jean Marais, who was a young actor and the friend of Jean Cocteau, and many others would come to his studio, and that in, you know, occupied Paris. After, he actually went to the south of France to seek probably the sun, and he had a new partner, Françoise Gillot, who he met in 43, much younger, and she gave him two children. He stayed just a little bit after the end of the war in Paris, became a member of the Communist Party, but he was bigger than the Communist Party in the sense that he had only joined the party out of friendship for friends and resistance during the war. But obviously, although he gave that well-known dove, he drew that very well-known dove for one of the peace communist-sponsored congress just after the war. But he found it completely pathetic, the attempts from the Communist Party to impose a new art, you know, the social realist art, that made him laugh hysterically.
So let's move on now to the great intellectuals, de Beauvoir and to Sartre. Of course, they are very central to this book. And you see that their sort of growth, if you like, through the occupation, through the liberation, through the purge afterwards, and really into what then becomes a new Europe.
Well, the thing is, with the war, they became politicized. If we take Beauvoir and Sartre, for instance, they were philosophy teachers. Their world was one of ideas, one of philosophy. They were not interested in what was happening in the world, really. And then Sartre, as a French soldier, was made prisoner of war. He tried to escape three times. And he reached Paris and told Simone de Beauvoir, we must do something. We must commit to the world we live in. We must try and change it from within. They tried a resistance group, but they didn't want to fight with weapons. They wanted to fight with words. So that was, short-lived, because all their friends actually wanted more active form of resistance. But still, they lived in occupied Paris. And Sartre talks and writes very, very well about that period. And then, in a way, their resistance, real resistance, active resistance, started after the liberation of Paris. They went on to create, to found Les Temps Modernes, which was a monthly magazine, and they really invented new journalism. We tend to think that it was invented in the streets of New York in the mid-50s, but I think it was really, they did it first in the mid-40s in Paris, this sort of melange of literature and reportage, which made it even more powerful than anything else. And they brought up subjects like abortion to the foreground of debates 30 years before it was made legal. Also, the first news of troubles in French Indochina was in Les Temps Modernes, years before it really reached anybody's ears in France. So they were at the forefront of world politics.
And at the forefront of sexual liberation.
From the beginning, and that was before the war. Yes, they had struck an agreement in a way when they were students in philosophy that they would not have children, that they would not marry. Although they both came from very bourgeois background, and that's what made them so controversial and perhaps so dangerous, because the bourgeoisie was very afraid of them. Here was two children of the bourgeoisie, very bright, and tearing up conventions in all directions, not only sexually. And they had what was called the Sartrean family, but really made of former students who were their occasional lovers and young colleagues. They had an incredible aura, and the younger generation was really drawn to them. They were also very generous mentors. They paid for everybody's rents, paid for everybody's food, and everybody's abortion, I must say. A lot of male students of Sartre would come and say, well, actually, I'm in trouble. Can you lend me some money? That they never return, but each time Sartre was there for them.
The book ends with really what is the idea that then becomes the European Union.
Yes, I wanted to end on this and the Marshall Plan. And to tell the story, I discovered the writings of and the work of Theodore H. White, who was then very well known in the 50s and 60s when he returned to the US to cover a lot of presidencies, and he got a Pulitzer for that. But before that, he had been a correspondent in Beijing, wrote bestsellers, and suddenly was blacklisted. Nobody would employ him in New York, although he was a very respected and celebrated writer. So a very obscure press agency contacted him saying, do you want to cover the implementation of the Marshall Plan in Paris? And he said, well, yes. And his writing is worth reading still today, because he's very clever and he explains it so well. And you realize how important the Marshall Plan was and how instrumental in the recovery of Europe and France. I end the book with him going and interviewing Jean Monnet, the Pope of the European construction. He, at the time, it was the steel union between six countries, so it was very pragmatic, very industrial, but really it was the seed of the European Union, the European project. And for Jean Monnet, who was only a civil servant, but he had a talent for big ideas and for selling those ideas to presidents, to heads of states, he invented, Theodore H. White invented, coined that phrase that we use all the time today, which is power broker, an expression that didn't exist before. And he coined it for Jean Monnet.
And of course, all of that hard work going in to produce this wonderful union, which we're about to smash to pieces. Agnès, thank you very much indeed for coming on to speak to me. Agnès Poirier, whose book Left Bank, Art, Passion and the Rebirth of Paris, 1940 to 1950, is published by Bloomsbury. It's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.